Good afternoon, everybody on the phone. I would like to welcome everybody to the Arsenic Health and Remediation Applications Internet Webinar Seminar Series. And this series is sponsored by the National Institute of Environmental Health Sciences, specifically the Superfund Research Program. Today's session is the second session in a series focused on arsenic, and it's titled Emerging Issues in Arsenic Exposure and Disease. My name is Reeder Sams. I'm going to be the moderator for today's session, and I'm the Acting Deputy Director for the Research Triangle Park Division within the National Center for Environmental Assessment of the U.S. EPA. We'll get started in just a few minutes, but while we wait for people to log on to both the Internet as well as the phone, there are a few housekeeping items that we would like to go over or logistical issues to kind of make this seminar series a little bit more user-friendly for everybody. So when you registered, you were directed to the seminar-specific URL, which is the front page of today's seminar, and the front page of the webcast contains a short abstract of today's session. We have also included short bio sketches of the presenters, and if you'll note there, underneath those bio sketches, the email addresses for each of the presenters for today's series are hot-linked to their email addresses. And if you have questions after today's seminar, please feel free to contact or use those email addresses. For those of you joining us on the phone lines today, your phones are actually placed on mute for the presentations. We will ask or have a question and answer session, at which time you can take your phones off the mute. But very importantly, we ask that people keep their phones on mute and do not place the phone call on hold. Sometimes there is music or you know, filler type stuff that will be very distracting for the seminar and take away from the presentations that will be provided today. To unmute your phone during the question and answer session, you will need to dial *7, and then to place your phone back on mute, you need to dial *6. And if everybody follows this, you know, it makes things much easier to have these types of teleconference presentations. So, and just again, to restate, do not put this call on hold to take another phone call during these presentations. By now, those of you participating via the phone lines should have the presentation open, and it should be on slide 1. All of those participating by the Internet, you should have clicked on Go to Session or Go to Seminar, the icon near the bottom of the page, and you should also be on slide 1. If you move to slide 2, the main page contains the slides, above which you will find the navigation icons, and Internet participants may submit questions by using the question icon, and you'll see that right above the slide. And you know, for people that have questions during the presentations, you know, please go ahead and put those in, and during the question and answer part of the presentations or the series, we will address those questions in order that they were received and alternating with people on the phone as well. So, you know, go ahead and put those questions in, and as we get to them, you know, we'll try to address those. If you have technical difficulties while the presentations are actually going on, please use that question icon as well. And also include your phone number when you submit that request, and they will try to troubleshoot that and find, you know, whatever the problem is and address that. The presenter will be announcing the number of the slide which they are speaking from, and as they advance to the next slide, they will indicate that. And for those of you on the Internet, you will have to advance your own slides, and for those of you that have downloaded the slides for today's presentations, you'll just go along and advance as well. At the end of the presentations, we will walk through our links page where we have assembled resources that are directly applicable to today's topics and presentations that are given. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form. We would ask that everybody, you know, please take some time and fill out that online feedback form. We do look at these comments, and we continually try to improve how these presentations are given and the seminar series to make them more useful, you know, to people that participate in these. We typically place the seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, and in the near future, you'll be able to access both the presentations as well as the audio that goes along with that. Past web seminars are also available on the CLUIN website and accessible via iTunes by searching for Superfund Research Program, which will take you to the Hazardous Waste Cleanup Information CLUIN archives. So with that being said, again, you know, for participants that are on the phone line, please make sure that you keep your phones on mute by pressing *6, and do not put the seminar on hold to take another phone call. So it is with my great pleasure today to introduce our first speaker, and our first presentation is by the Superfund Research Program researcher, Dr. Alan Smith. Dr. Alan Smith was appointed as a professor of occupational environmental epidemiology at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health in 1983. During the last 20 years, he has developed an international research program related to the health effects of arsenic in drinking water. He initiated major EPI studies in California, Nevada, Argentina, and Chile, with a view to determining cancer and other health effects caused by arsenic. In 1995, following the discovery to the outside world of the arsenic catastrophe in West Bengal and Bangladesh, he commenced several research projects in rural West Bengal, India, concerning arsenic in drinking water, and he is currently conducting a study in children exposed to arsenic in Bangladesh. He has given emphasis to plans for intervention and evaluation of mitigation programs to reduce population arsenic exposure, and is currently including a pilot dug well program to provide arsenic-free water in India, supported by private donors. Dr. Alan Smith has served on the National Research Council Subcommittee on Arsenic in Drinking Water, and he was previously president of the International Society for Environmental Epidemiology, and in 1997 chaired the epidemiology section of IARC Working Group on Dioxins and Furans, and was a member of the IARC Working Group on Arsenic in 2002. He was recently a member of the National Toxicology Program Board of Scientific Counselors, and he is currently the director of the Berkeley NIH Fogarty International Research and Training Development Program in Environmental and Occupational Health with collaborating centers and trainees based in India. In 2009, he received the John Goldsmith Award from the International Society for Environmental Epidemiology for sustained and outstanding contributions to the knowledge and practice of environmental epidemiology. I think Dr. Smith is probably one of the most notable researchers in this area, and it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Smith, and I will turn the microphone over to Dr. Smith.
Well, hello, and thank you very much for that long introduction. I am titled in my talk, Astonishing Long-Term Effects, and they have been, to me, astonishing, the findings from mothers exposed in pregnancy and their children and what happens to them as young adults. I'm based at the Arsenic Health Effects Research Program at Berkeley, and I'm going to start by telling you why I study arsenic, slide 4. I was reading through the periodic table one day, and I came down to number 33, and I said, Alan Smith. I've got to study arsenic, and that's it. Actually, our group's called the Arsenic Research Group. It's often confused with Alan Smith's research group, which is not the title. I do want to mention Associate Director Craig Steinmaus, who's had extensive involvement in directing many of our projects. That's Craig. This is in the north of Chile. He's not taking water samples from that river. He actually was visiting home on the other side of the river to get some water samples to test for arsenic. Now, when I first started research on arsenic in water, it's more than 20 years now, we only knew it caused skin lesions, the pigmentation changes in the skin, and keratoses. And we also knew it caused skin cancer, but that was it. In 1988, C.J. Chan from Taiwan, a leading researcher on arsenic, published findings in a letter to Lancet, which were astonishing also. Astonishing because it was lung cancer, and how on earth could arsenic in water cause lung cancer? He compared villages with average arsenic in water concentrations as shown, and the lung cancer mortality rates went up to more than eightfold in women and more than fourfold in men. But when I looked at that, I thought, well, this is surprising. How on earth could this happen? We know various causes of lung cancer, slide 10. They all involve inhalation. Smoking, passive smoking, asbestos dust inhalation, radon inhalation, silica dust, chromium, diesel exhaust, PAHs, bisperometal ether, nickel, and arsenic inhalation. We knew that. We knew that smelter workers actually had high rates of lung cancer. In slide 11, we'd used those Taiwan data to estimate that if they were valid, then the risk that the then drinking water standard of 50 micrograms per liter would be extremely high. 1 liter a day could result in 13 per thousand persons dying from cancer. At the time, we were attacked for these estimates. Many people did not believe them. I might mention at outset that it's not just these countries in other parts of the world that have high arsenic in the water. I call the lost and forgotten arsenic-exposed population people in the United States consuming water from private wells, and there could be more than 2 million over the current standard. And the next slide, slide 13, Fallon is at the center of where many of these wells are. And in recent studies with students that Craig Steinmaus led, the well measures were given here by two methods. We were actually there evaluating field test kits, but both the vertical axis and the horizontal are arsenic concentrations. And you can see they're large numbers, above 100 micrograms per liter in water in private wells, up to, in this particular slide, the 400, although we've seen wells much higher than that. Now, some of the people know about it and put arsenic removal systems on their water, but unfortunately, they are not explained carefully the instructions that they have to maintain them. They have to replace membranes and so on. And this is a slide showing pre-filter concentrations in private wells in Nevada. You can see going up to about 900 micrograms per liter. And then a sample of the water, the tap water actually used in the home. And you can see in four of those, the system was not working, and in fact, the highest one was still over 600 micrograms per liter. Now, why don't we just study these U.S. populations? Why did we go elsewhere? The problem was that they were scattered and much harder to study, and the numbers were much smaller. So for that reason, after going to several countries, we focused in particular on Chile. Chile in the north is a wonderful area. The Andes Mountains are there in the background, the driest desert on Earth. It sometimes doesn't rain in a year at all. And up in Region 2, we were able to look at lung cancer mortality 89 to 93 after seeing the Taiwan findings, so we had a priori hypothesis. And we found lung cancer increased in the right column SMR, standardized mortality ratio, in women 3.1 times that in the rest of Chile, and in men 3.8 that in the rest of Chile. And you can see it affected all age groups. So this was quite startling to me at the time. We had some suspicion about the findings from Taiwan, but the very first countries, Argentina and Chile, where we were able to look, we found also marked increased risk in lung cancer in persons drinking high concentrations of arsenic in water. Well, we already knew that it was a cause of lung cancer from inhalation, and this is just a graph from Phil Antoline's work, where he took urinary arsenic measurements in workers and looked at lung cancer rates. And you can see in these workers inhaling arsenic, the risk go up to eightfold. Then Caterina Ferreccio in Chile did a case control study, and this now is water arsenic concentration, and the relative risks go up quite similar to about sevenfold. Now, after a few years, we suddenly sort of putting these lines on the same graph and plotting them against urinary arsenic concentration along the x-axis. And you can see they're very close, and those are confidence intervals, and they're really overlaying each other. And then we realized that it didn't matter whether arsenic was ingested or inhaled. It had to get inside the body. It had to get into the lung cells, and they were in equilibrium with the blood system, lymphatics, and so on. So it made a lot of sense. It doesn't matter whether you inhale it or ingest it. What matters is the dose that's absorbed into the body. So what initially started off as something that seemed to me rather ridiculous, that you could ingest arsenic and get high lung cancer rates, has in recent times become something, well, it sort of makes sense. It's a little obvious. Now, the risks, then, were extremely high. Here on slide 21, we estimated cancer risks 50 micrograms per liter, which was then the standard. And they were 100 times higher than anything else in the standard setting in the United States for drinking water contaminants. At that time, the risks of the highest one was ethylene dibromide. 12 per 100,000 deaths was at the drinking water standard. On slide 23, if you put arsenic on the same graph, everything else pales into insignificance. The cancer risks from arsenic at the old drinking water standard were 100 times higher than the next highest risk contaminant. The risks are so high, all you can do is compare it with smoking. On the left, various concentrations in drinking water. Now, we don't know about that 10 micrograms per liter one. That's just extrapolating down, but if we go up to 500 micrograms per liter, we know that about 1 in 10 will die, maybe more. That's like an active smoker. 1 in 10 die from lung cancer. If we extrapolate down to 50 micrograms per liter, we would estimate maybe 1 in 100 will die from it. And that's like being a non-smoker married to a smoker who smokes inside the house. So the arsenic risks in drinking water are exceedingly high, and the only comparable risks are from active smoking. And the problem here is that arsenic in water looks good, does not smell, and has no taste. So people did not believe the risk, at least initially. Then we were able in Chile, in slide 25, a study with Guillermo Marshall in plotting out the lung cancer mortality rates, which included coding 200,000 death certificates from earlier years, a major undertaking in Chile. The blue line here on slide 26 is the actual lung cancer relative risk, and the pink lines are the confidence intervals. The exposure in the north started in 1958. It stopped in 1971, but look at those lung cancer rates. They go on up, they continue along, and as we've now submitting for publication in 2007, 8, 9, the rates are still elevated. They're a remarkable long latency for any cause of cancer. Well, after these years, initially starting thinking that arsenic caused skin lesions and skin cancer, what do we know now? It seems that it's easier to have a list of things arsenic doesn't cause. Here are some that we think it does: lung and laryngeal cancer, effects on lung function, bronchiectasis, chronic cough. We think tuberculosis mortality has increased. In the renal tract, bladder and kidney cancer, chronic renal failure. Cardiovascular system, acute myocardial infarction, cerebrovascular effects, and so on. An astonishing list that keeps growing year by year. Now, what about this early life exposure, though? We know that some children develop skin lesions. These are the classic pigmentation changes in a young boy. In the north there, in Chile and Antofagasta, on slide 30, they had a water source less than 100 micrograms per liter. Overnight, they switched to new contaminated systems piped from rivers inland. They started getting signs and symptoms, so in 1970, they installed the first major arsenic removal plant in the world. And that's a wonderful, for us epidemiologists, natural experiment. We could look now at childhood cancer. There's relatively about one, but if we look at childhood liver cancer, for those born 1950 to 57 who would have been exposed as young children, the death rate from liver cancer aged 10 to 19 was up round about tenfold in both boys and girls. We looked also at lung cancer, and here we were able to look at the peak exposure period, 1958 to 1970, and look when they were born in relationship to it. Born long before it, therefore only exposed as adults, the relative risk estimate of about 4. Born just before, who would have exposure as young children, the relative risk about 13. And they're dying age 35 to 39. Then born during with an utero exposure, even a little higher, about the same. Dying age 30 to 34 from lung cancer. Exceedingly unusual to die at that age from lung cancer. But in this population with in utero and early life exposure, there are these marked increases. What can we compare that to? Well, one is the atomic bomb, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, environmental tobacco smoke. The arsenic risks are much higher. In other words, the arsenic lung cancer risks from in utero and early life exposure are much higher than anything else we know about. On slide 38 is a picture of the horrible disease, bronchiectasis. You end up with pus in the lungs and ultimately many die from it. You can take CT scans, and this is in India, slide 39, with Dr. Guha Mazumdar. 7,600 surveyed, 108 selected for the CT scan in slide 40. Then those with 27 had chronic cough down the left bottom. 18 had evidence of bronchiectasis, only 3 in those not exposed. So there's a tenfold increased prevalence of bronchiectasis in this study. An unexpected finding, although bronchiectasis had been mentioned by investigators in the north of Chile. Lung function reduced in slide 41. On the left, men with arsenic skin lesions, quite marked reduction. Women, not so much. Interestingly, in this population in West Bengal, India, the reduction in lung function with skin lesions was more than the reduction due to smoking alone, which is the second column. Now, it happens they don't smoke very heavily, but if I go to the left column, that reduction in lung function, 256 milliliters, is about the same as regular smokers in the United States. So again, arsenic has not only cancer effects in the lungs similar to smoking, but also effects on other non-malignant lung conditions. Slide 42, now in Chile again. In the left, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease is elevated. But I want to point you to the top right graph. Here with this a priori hypothesis again, bronchiectasis in those with in utero exposure, the blue column, more than 45-fold increased mortality from bronchiectasis in those with in utero and early life exposure. In those who actually only had childhood exposure, in other words, born just before the high exposure period, there also marked increased risk, although not as high, more than 12-fold increased risk in death from bronchiectasis, and this is in young adults, age 30 to 49. Now I want to switch a little. In the introduction, Sam mentioned the project in India, which is directed by my wife, and I promise her I will say something about it in every presentation. There's a good job on the top left if you want to dig a dug well, and they put the pipe in it. Eventually they end up with this covered system and a hand pump to get arsenic-free water. It's supported by private donors, slide 44, and there's a website there if you'd like more information on that program. Okay, now I want to switch back to Bangladesh. There we're studying about 600 children, specially selected in a MATLAB region, to have many exposed less than 10 micrograms per liter, that's the left column, nearly 300 children never known to have been exposed in utero or childhood to more than 10 micrograms per liter. And then there's a distribution of exposure in utero. The peak there is 300 to 499 micrograms per liter, and then some exposed way over 1,000 micrograms per liter. This was done with our collaborators, Dr. Yunus and Dr. Fajal. And here's one of the participants about to do lung function testing. They're extremely collaborative and very nice people to work with. I just want to present one slide of findings, that's slide 48. This is the odds ratio's estimate for various symptoms. Wheeze, asthma, congested when not having a cold. Again, beside that, shortness of breath when walking fast or climbing or walking on level ground, and to the right, wheeze when not having a cold. And the exposures there, the green are the never exposed to more than 10 micrograms per liter. The blue is 10 to 500 micrograms per liter, and the orange is 500 plus. And you can see this marked increase in respiratory symptoms when they're aged between 7 and 17, following this in utero and early childhood exposure to arsenic. So already their lungs are starting to be affected, although surprisingly we have not yet found reduced lung function test results in this population. Well, another cause of death, acute myocardial infarction, and here we've compared acute myocardial infarction with lung cancer and bladder cancer. This again is in Chile. The blue there is acute myocardial infarction. 50 to 57 before they change the water source to high arsenic. Nothing doing. Then 58 to 64 immediately, myocardial infarction rate goes up. And you can see it continues. The removal plant was put in 71 and gradually it comes down, whereas the lung cancer and bladder cancer in green, the purple and the green, take over risk in the long term. But in the short term, the highest risk turned out to be from acute myocardial infarction. But the very highest amongst them were age 30 to 49 with probable exposure in utero and in early childhood. Relative risk estimate of 3.2, not as spectacular as some of the others, but acute myocardial infarction is a very common cause of death, so this is a major increase in risk. What about the other causes of death? We've summarized them in this graph. Bladder cancer overall more than 21-fold, and again, they're young adults really to be dying from cancer or dying from anything, age 30 to 49. This is published. It's in Environmental Health Perspectives now online. Laryngeal cancer was a surprise, more than tenfold increase. Lung cancer overall, close to sevenfold. Kidney cancer increased. Liver cancer increased. Then in the non-cancer causes of death, I've already mentioned bronchiectasis. Then we have the other chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Chronic renal disease also was increased. So arsenic is not only causing kidney cancer and bladder cancer, but also there's evidence that it affects the kidney and leads to death from chronic renal failure. And I've mentioned the acute myocardial infarction. Well, we started looking at these causes one by one. We first looked at lung cancer and eventually looked at them all and were astonished to see this pattern of many causes of death in young adults increased following early life exposure. Well, what about scientific plausibility? These are startling findings, but studies in mice by NIEHS have shown increased tumors in offspring of mice dosed with 85,000 micrograms per liter, including bladder and lung tumors. And these very high doses, which Dr. Walkies and his team used, were to try to achieve internal organ concentrations similar to highly exposed humans, because mice excrete arsenic very rapidly. Well, what about lower risks? In Chile, the concentrations were about 850 micrograms per liter. Very large population, and we're looking for very rare outcomes, mortality in young adults. Well, I think that some risk might be detectable by very large studies with exposure around 100 micrograms per liter. It will be very hard to do. It's hard to find large numbers. Again, in the north of Chile, the population was 200,000, all exposed to the same concentrations. I think if the risk at less than 50 micrograms per liter, it is unlikely that epidemiological studies would ever find them. And I believe we need to think in terms of extrapolation of risk downwards and margins of safety, and I do think that these findings of young adults dying from early life exposure mean that we should make sure there are even greater margins of safety than we might want to have if there are only older people dying from arsenic in drinking water. So early life exposure to high concentrations of arsenic in water has major impact on young adult mortality beyond that from any other environmental exposure. In fact, there's nothing like it. The only thing comparable is very high dose radiation treatment of earlier cancers. The subsequent cancers may develop in such people and they may die from them, but there's no environmental exposure that one can compare to arsenic in drinking water and its impact on young adult mortality. I'd like to thank you for your attention and note that many of these studies were funded by NIH through NIEHS and also the Superfund Research Program. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. This is Reader Sams. We'd like to now enter into the question-answer period for this presentation. And is there anybody on the phone that would like to ask a question of Dr. Smith? And if so, to unmute your phone, press star 7.
Hi, my name is Tamara Sorrell. I have a question about whether you have looked at the arsenic speciation in any of these studies or any of the bioavailability issues.
Well, yes, we have. Firstly, when we started in the literature, it was often said that you had to differentiate trivalent arsenic from pentavalent arsenic in water. In fact, you don't. The first step inside the body for pentavalent arsenic is reduction to trivalent, and we know that happens because in order to get methylated, it has to first be reduced. So whether you drink pentavalent arsenic or trivalent arsenic, in my opinion, makes no difference. Now, it would if it was an acute poison. If you're trying to kill somebody, you should give them trivalent arsenic because you're trying to overload their system. But in chronic steady state from drinking water, in my opinion, it makes no difference whether it's trivalent or pentavalent. Now, with regard to the absorbed dose, we know that from urine concentrations. We've done many studies with urine concentrations in Chile, Argentina, Bangladesh, India, Nevada, California, and it is absorbed. And about 70% is excreted in the urine. So there's no question about its availability when it's present in drinking water.
This is Pat Cassano from GE. My questions actually relate to the article that Dr. Henry circulated last week, I think it was. The first question has to do with the period for which mortality data was studied. The study indicates that mortality data was studied for 1989 to 2000. Did you look at mortality data for years subsequent to 2000?
Well, we have now, yes. The current studies in the north of Chile are case control studies. They involve lung cancer, bladder cancer, kidney cancer. And these are newly diagnosed patients for the years 2007 to 2010. And the risks are still increased, amazingly, because this is now nearly 40 years after the exposures were markedly reduced with the arsenic removal plant. In fact, the only latency like it that I know of is for asbestos dust and the cancer mesothelioma, where cases can occur 30, 40, 50 years even after the exposure. Arsenic also seems to have this very long latency, which is unlike smoking. With smokers, after 10 years stopping, there's clear reduction. After 20 years stopping smoking, lung cancer risks get quite close to those of never smokers. They never quite get the same, but they're not much elevated. So there is this very long latency. So that's the other end of it, the more recent. In terms of before 89, the reason we chose 89 is that was the first year we could differentiate the people actually living in Antofagasta, the city where there was this very high concentration. So we have looked at mortality rates before that, and the lung cancer slide I showed goes right back to 1958, but we are not able to differentiate those born in Antofagasta in the data available in Chile before 1989.
And I apologize. I only joined the call maybe 5 minutes ago because I was on another call. Is there an article, or will you be, preparing an article that integrates all of the data from 89 to 2010?
No, we are currently publishing the case control studies, and I guess at some point we may produce a summary paper of all the findings from the north of Chile. I know when I first went there, I had no idea that we would keep finding things and there would be so many studies and so much to do, but we seem to be so busy doing the newer studies, we have not done an overall review paper, which I think I think is needed. If people would find that helpful, I think it would be.
I have a couple other questions, but I won't ask them in case somebody else has a question, and if nobody does, then I would if there's time. So.
Okay. We have several questions coming in over the internet, and I'd like to just pose a few of those for the people that have submitted them. The first of which is submitted by Mari Eggers from Montana State University, and her question states, we are testing people's homes' well water for arsenic, among other contaminants. Do you think that 10 micrograms per liter as the standard is sufficiently protective that people with a lower level arsenic below 10 micrograms per liter in their well water need not be concerned? Or what advice do you think that we should give them?
Well, when I advise people, I'm often asked that sort of thing, and I would say, well, if I had water below 10, which I do, I wouldn't worry about it. I think in the West Bengal and in Bangladesh, for example, if we can find a well below 50, we advise them to drink it. Now, we can find one below 10, we certainly encourage them to do that. I might say there has been various discussions and work on whether or not 10 is an adequate margin of safety for arsenic, and I think these are very complicated issues because the problem with the water standard is if you keep going down, then arsenic in food becomes the main source of inorganic arsenic. So there's sort of like diminishing returns from just lowering the drinking water standard. And I personally believe that we should also be thinking in terms of standards for food, as others are, in particular rice, which can contain quite high levels of inorganic arsenic. And one particular commodity, baby rice, is a particular concern there, because that would expose infants.
And the next question from the internet is submitted by Yasmin Nkrumah Ely from Oregon State University, and the question states, are there any biomarkers of exposure that are reliable to detect in utero exposure, either in utero or during early life? And are there any treatment methods that may be useful in children?
Well, the main biomarker for current exposure is urine concentrations, and one can, and there have been studies taking urine concentrations during pregnancy. One can also measure arsenic in hair and nails, but the easiest one is urine concentrations. In our work in Bangladesh, we didn't have that urine concentrations back in time, but what we did have was the concentrations in the well water they were using at that time. And the second question in terms of treatment, no. When I wrote my report to WHO on Bangladesh, I said the first priority is to reduce arsenic exposure. The second priority is to maintain it reduced. And the third priority is to confirm that it is reduced. And in my opinion, there is no sign of an effective treatment. And we have worked with some studies with chelating agents, but arsenic is excreted very rapidly. If you stop exposure, the majority is excreted in 1 week. And after a month, you're back down to background concentrations in urine. So I don't think one can make a case for an agent to remove arsenic from the body, but one does need to make sure that wherever there's wells, that people know the arsenic level in them, especially if it's a pregnant mother or young infants.
With that, you know, to kind of take turns here, are there any other questions on the phone that people would like to ask of Dr. Smith?
Yeah, this is Todd Finlayson with AECOM. Are these, you were mentioning, Either the northern Chile or the India and Bangladesh areas, is this arsenic that's just natural in the geology, or are there specific sources?
No, it's natural, and for some reason it gets into the water. Everywhere in the world it's natural except for one or two places. There are some superfund sites with some arsenic in them. Also in Japan there's quite a famous factory that made arsenic trioxide that led to contamination of the local wells. But in all the data I've presented and in these other countries, arsenic's in the Earth's crust. In the north of Chile, it's in the Andes Mountains, and the snow melts, then seeps into the mountains and comes out as thermal waters that form the river, and it's picked up arsenic on the way through the mountains. It's a natural source nearly always.
We'll take one more question from the internet, and then we'll probably move on to the next presentation. And this question comes from Brian Lee from GE Global Research Center. And the question states, there's a fairly significant discrepancy between male and female in regards to the specific cancers that were analyzed. For example, bladder, larynx, and liver, particularly in the cohort born from 1940 to 1957. Is there a hypothesis that explains this difference?
Well, the differences are not consistent. I might say that there is some confusion in this, because if you, for example, take lung cancer in men and have a relative risk of 4 and a lung cancer relative risk in women of 8, that does not mean to say the absolute risks are higher in women. because the background rate of lung cancer in most populations due to smoking is much higher in men. So if you multiply that times 4, you can have even a greater increased risk. So actually there's a lot of confusion in it. I would note that in some things men seem to be more susceptible, but there's not marked distinction. And in any case, it's clear that there's no major gender difference in the long-term outcome. Both genders are dying from all these causes that I've talked about.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Smith. To keep with the schedule that we have today for these presentations, we'd like to move on. We really appreciate your presentation, Dr. Smith, and hopefully if time allows, maybe there be some time for questions at the end of both presentations. With that being said, I would like to introduce our second speaker for today, and that is Dr. Josh Hamilton. He is a Superfund research researcher from Dartmouth College. Dr. Hamilton is the Chief Academic and Scientific Officer at the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, where he is also a senior scientist at the MBL's Bay Paul Center. He also holds a joint faculty appointment at Brown University in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine. Dr. Hamilton received a BS in biology from Bridgewater State College and an MS in genetics and a PhD in toxicology, both from Cornell University. Following a postdoctoral fellowship through the Norris Cotton Cancer Center, he joined the faculty at the Dartmouth Medical School, where he is a professor of pharmacology and toxicology with adjunct appointments in chemistry and biology. At Dartmouth, he was also the founding director of the Center for Environmental Health Sciences and the director of Dartmouth's NIHS-sponsored Superfund research program project on toxic metals from 1997 to 2008. He also served as the associate director of the Norris Cotton Cancer Center, and he has joined the NBL in 2008, but has remained as a project leader in the Dartmouth SRP Toxics Metals Program project. He is also affiliated with the Brown University Superfund Research Program and with Brown's NIEHS-sponsored Children's Environmental Health Center as an external advisor. With that being said, I would welcome Dr. Hamilton to provide his presentation, and we will go from there. Dr. Hamilton?
Thank you, Reader, and thank you all for joining me and participating in this seminar. I wanted to present to you some research that's complementary to what Alan Smith just presented, where we looked at mouse and other animal models to try to understand the basis for all of these effects that arsenic has been associated with. So the first slide, are arsenic and old concerns, just points out that although arsenic has been known as a poison for a long time, beginning more than 100 years ago, people began to have concerns about arsenic and health effects at much lower doses, principally at that time in occupational settings, but more and more in environmental settings. So this is a quote by Carl Vogel, that it's this uncanny thought that there's this lurking poison everywhere around us, in the food we eat, the water we drink, and the air we breathe, and we believe that that's still true today. So the next slide, returning to the periodic table that Alan Smith showed you, I wanted to make a couple of points. He pointed out to you the position of arsenic on position 33 over in the middle right of the periodic table. You notice that it's right on the edge, this jagged line between the purple and the green here. Basically from that jagged line all the way to the left are all metals. So basically three-quarters of the elements that make up the universe are metals. They dominate the natural world and in many ways biology, and to the right are the non-metals. Arsenic sits right on the edge of that border. It's actually called a metalloid. It's not a true metal. It has properties of both metals and non-metals, and there's only a few elements like this, and that gives it very unique biological properties. I also want to point out, for those of you who aren't toxicologists or don't think about metals very often, that the term heavy metal is not a toxicology term, it's a chemistry term. Heavy metals are heavy, they're at the bottom of the periodic table. Light metals are at the top. The ones in the middle are neither heavy nor light. So there's no toxicity information in that term. but it's often used by the lay press and others in lieu of saying toxic metal. Most of the metals that you see on this table either have very important biological roles, such as iron and nickel and copper and zinc, or they are metals that mimic those and therefore can cause toxicity. So, for example, cadmium looks enough like zinc chemically that it can interfere with processes that zinc normally participates in, and this is the basis of its toxicity. Lead is a heavy metal, and it looks like calcium, but, for example, gold is a very heavy metal and is essentially inert. So I just give this by way of background because it's very important to distinguish metals that are toxic versus non-toxic. We've talked about the valence of arsenic in the previous talk. It's in two principal states, +3 and +5 in the inorganic form, and those are the forms that we're most concerned about in environmental settings. So the next slide, just point out that all of those toxic metals are of concern both at Superfund sites and other toxic waste sites and also in the environment in general. And the top three chemicals of concern for the Center for Disease Control are arsenic, lead, and mercury in that order, with arsenic being the number one. And likewise, the EPA's OSWR priority list has arsenic, lead, and mercury at the top of that priority list. So next slide, arsenic's been referred to as the poison of kings and the king of poisons. Most of us know it through its ability to be an acute poison. And as was mentioned before, it's odorless, colorless, and tasteless. And so this is what makes it a good poison. Not that it's particularly potent compared to other poisons like cyanide, but because it could be slipped into food and water and be undetected, it was highly favored as a poisoning agent. And this makes it very difficult as an environmental agent in water and food as well, because it's very difficult to detect. Next slide. As an environmental contaminant, as was mentioned, this first came to light in places like West Bengal and Bangladesh because the World Health Organization, in digging these tube wells to prevent people from drinking cholera-infested surface water, inadvertently tapped into underground sources of arsenic, geological sources that got into the water. And it took many years before these effects were observed. And so both in Chile, which was talked about earlier, and in places like Bangladesh, it took years or in some cases decades before these health effects emerged at these very high concentrations. And in those areas, typically the levels that got our attention were in the hundreds of parts per billion. But as we do more and more studies, we realize that levels below this are also of significant health concern. There's been various estimates of how many people are exposed in the world to what we would consider excess arsenic, but it's certainly in the hundreds of millions worldwide. And most of this is undetectable and unknown to the end user because these are either private wells or otherwise unregulated. So the next slide just summarizes again some of the myriad effects that arsenic's been associated with. As was mentioned, this list literally grows every year as we learn more and more about what arsenic is associated with. There is no other toxicant that I'm aware of that has been associated with so many diseases and so many different types of diseases. And so it's really quite puzzling how a simple agent, an element really, could be associated with so many different disease risks. The ones I want to focus on here are the various cancers, diabetes and other metabolic diseases, and reproductive and developmental problems. And we'll focus on some of these aspects as we move forward. So our program project is centered at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, and the focus of our work when we began our Superfund program in the mid-90s was this growing recognition that arsenic was a huge problem in northern New England. In New Hampshire, for example, about 40% of the population gets its drinking water from private, unregulated wells because it's a very rural environment. Of these wells, we now know that greater than 1 in 5 of these has what we would consider excess arsenic above the current 10 part per billion drinking water standard. This represents about 10% of the state's population, or 120,000 people just in New Hampshire alone. in Maine, we see similar ratios. Maine's a slightly larger state, so we're talking about perhaps 150,000 people drinking excess arsenic. And various estimates have been made across the U.S. of how many people this entails. It's certainly in the millions, perhaps in the tens of millions, who may be drinking what we now consider excess arsenic, primarily through private, unregulated wells. So the EPA regulates public water supplies, but I think the general public does not really appreciate that this does not cover private wells, and that if one wants to know what they're drinking, you have to voluntarily test your own water and then understand the results and perhaps take some action to remediate them. The next slide just gives an overview of our program project at Dartmouth and what led us to focus in particular on arsenic. We've attacked this in a number of different ways. We have epidemiology studies that are looking using case control methods to look at cancer risks and other health risks in the New Hampshire population, and then a number of different cellular and molecular and animal studies to try to understand the basis of this problem. And my project, Project 2, is one of these molecular toxicology projects. So I'd like to tell you three vignettes of recent work from our lab that highlight some of the different things that arsenic can do and some of the potential risks associated with the epidemiology studies that Dr. Smith and others have been doing. And the first is arsenic as an endocrine disruptor. I got here on this next slide then the EPA definition of an endocrine disruptor. It's a very, very broad definition. So these are collectively chemicals with the potential to interfere with endocrine systems. And as shown here, the EPA believes that any exogenous agent that interferes with the production, release, transport, metabolism, binding, action, or elimination of the natural hormones would be considered an endocrine disruptor. Very broad definition. I believe this is appropriate. You can imagine different chemicals perturbing the hormone system of the body in different ways, and any one of these could lead to adverse consequences. And so I think this is highly appropriate. Next slide. But in practice, in fact, most of us have focused on endocrine disruptors in a very, very narrow context. So what we're looking at here is a cartoon of the cell. The upper boundary there is the cell membrane, and then you see a lower boundary there, which is the separation between the cytoplasm and the nucleus. The way hormones work, by definition, is they're produced in one part of the body, they travel through the bloodstream, and they do action somewhere else. So, for example, at the top, you see the glucocorticoid hormone, which is one of the steroid hormones in our body. It's produced by a gland, travels through the blood system. In this case, it's now entering a cell. And what each hormone does is bind to a very specific receptor. Glucocorticoid hormone to its receptor, estrogen to its receptor, and so on. And this is a very tight and very specific binding. That leads to activation of that receptor. And typically what happens with most of these hormone receptors is they are activated in a way that they go to the nucleus and act as transcription factors and turn on or turn off gene expression. And that's how they elicit their hormone response at the molecular level. The vast majority of endocrine disrupting chemicals that have been so far described mimic hormones in one of two ways. They either look enough like a hormone to bind to this receptor and, for example, mimic estrogen and turn on that receptor as if they're estrogen. So that would be considered an agonist. Or they bind to the receptor well enough to look like estrogen, but the receptor is not activated and just sits there. And the endocrine disruptor is now blocking the ability of the natural hormone to bind and do its work. And these are called competitive antagonists. Either of these could lead to problems, as you could imagine. Well, we found that arsenic is an endocrine disruptor, but it doesn't do either of these things. In fact, it acts by a completely different mechanism than this, even though it perturbs these receptors in very profound ways. So the next slide shows a graph of a typical experiment that we did in the early days when we were first defining arsenic as an endocrine disruptor. And what you're looking at here is the level of gene expression of a marker gene on the y-axis, and on the x-axis, different concentrations of arsenic and their effects. the dotted line at the bottom is the basal expression of this gene in the absence of hormone. And what you see is that when you add arsenic, even up to, in this case, 3 micromolar, essentially nothing happens. Arsenic by itself does not perturb the basal expression of this gene. If you go over to the far left at 0 arsenic, but you see where we added the natural hormone, the glucocorticoid receptor in this case, agonist, that would activate this gene, you see it goes up several fold. It goes from about 4 units here to almost 40 units, so about a tenfold activation of this gene. And that's a typical response of a hormone responsive gene. And then as we move to the right, we're adding arsenic in the presence of hormone. And the first thing you see in the upper left, circled in the red there, is that at very low concentrations of arsenic, it actually supercharges this receptor. We get a 2 to 2.5-fold enhancement in hormone signaling by the natural hormone in the presence of arsenic. As we increase the concentration, this absolutely reverses. And so at the highest concentrations at the far right, we see that arsenic, still at non-toxic concentrations, but at higher than the previous ones, almost completely suppresses the ability of this hormone to activate its gene. There are two other points of interest on this graph. The first one on the far left is the true no observed effect level. There is a dose of arsenic at or below which essentially we don't see any effect on the hormone response. But there's a second apparent no observed effect, which is the third circle from the left there. And if you happen to do the experiment right at that concentration, it would appear as if arsenic had no effect. And yet if you just go slightly above or slightly below that dose, you see either enhancement or suppression. This is a very unusual dose response. Arsenic is doing two completely opposite things over a very narrow concentration. And our simplest explanation for this is that there are actually at least two different targets. At very low concentrations, there's a high affinity target which seems to further activate the hormone response. At higher doses, there's another target that kicks in which has a lower affinity for arsenic, but which is dominant over the first. And so at those concentrations, the overall effect is suppression. Supercharging the receptor may sound like a good idea. You get a better hormone response, but in fact, if you doubled or tripled the estrogen response or the insulin response, you're going to have just as much adverse effects as if you completely suppress that hormone. So this very complicated dose response tells us a couple things. First, that arsenic does perturb hormones, but secondly, that it does it in an extremely complex and dose-dependent manner. Next slide. So we did this kind of experiment with many different hormones and many different receptors, and what we found is that arsenic broadly perturbs a number of different nuclear receptors, and this also makes it unusual because most endocrine disruptors target a single hormone receptor. Pesticides, for example, that look like estrogen, but they don't really perturb any of the other hormone receptors. Here, arsenic perturbed many different kinds of receptors all approximately the same way, which was quite unusual. So we then asked what we call the so what question, which is that if this is really true, that arsenic is an endocrine disruptor, then could we see an effect on whole animals for some system that depends on hormone? And here we looked at metamorphosis in frogs. So on the bottom here, you see pictures of frogs as they go through metamorphosis. On the left, they start out looking like a fish. They swim in water with a tail. They have gills. And then magically, as they metamorphose, they go from looking like a fish on the left to looking like a mouse on the right, where they shed their tail. They grow arms and legs. They switch from gills to lungs. They crawl out of the water, and now they're a land-dwelling animal. This process is driven in principal part by thyroid hormone. And what we wanted to know was, would arsenic perturb this system? On the next slide, you see 8 panels with pictures of frog tails. On the upper 4 panels are tails at day 1, at the beginning of the experiment, under various conditions. And at the bottom is those same tails at day 4. So on the far left, you see that in the controls, This TL, if you don't add any hormone or arsenic to it, does not do much of anything over 3 days. The second from the left, you see T3, that's the thyroid hormone. If you add thyroid hormone alone, you see at the bottom the tail very dramatically shrinks. It's undergoing metamorphosis. The third panel from the left is arsenic alone, which, again, doesn't do much by itself. But on the far right, you see that if you add thyroid hormone in the presence of a low concentration of arsenic, the arsenic almost completely blocks the ability of this tail to metamorphose in response to its normal hormone treatment. We've done many experiments like this in different animal systems, and in every case we were able to show that very low concentrations of arsenic can profoundly affect the ability of those hormone systems to respond normally. So the next slide just summarizes what we've seen so far. As I mentioned, arsenic affects a broad array of steroid receptors, all five steroid receptors, in fact, for estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, glucocorticoids, and mineralocorticoids, as well as a number of other receptors, retinoic acid, thyroid hormone, and the PPAR receptors. We've actually stopped testing additional receptors because we have yet to find a nuclear hormone receptor that does not respond to arsenic in this way. And as I mentioned, arsenic tends to enhance hormone signaling at very low doses and to suppress it at slightly higher doses. So the next vignette is to talk about arsenic and lung disease. And Dr. Smith mentioned the strong epidemiology that links arsenic with various lung diseases, and I want to focus on bronchiectasis in particular. As he mentioned, arsenic is unique in that it increases lung cancer risk and these other diseases not by inhalation but by ingestion, which is really quite remarkable for a toxicant. The next slide just points you back to these very powerful studies that were done by Dr. Smith's group in Chile, and I want to focus on bronchiectasis on the far left there. As he mentioned, you see a different risk depending on whether people were born before this 12-year period of arsenic exposure, were exposed in utero and in early childhood, which is in the black bar, or comparison to the rest of Chile. And we have over a 45-fold increased risk of bronchiectasis in those born in utero and in early childhood during this period of very high arsenic exposure. Just a remarkable change in relative risk of any disease. But we were very intrigued by bronchiectasis in particular because it's thought that this is principally a result of immune deficiencies which lead to chronic lung infections over a lifetime, which ultimately lead to the pathology that Dr. Smith showed you in that slide. The next slide, we attempted to set up a mouse experiment that might mimic this idea. So we started with young adult male mice to set the stage for what this might look like. And we're looking here at the time course for effects of infection of mice by the flu with or without an arsenic exposure in their drinking water. So the black line shows you mice on regular drinking water. They were given the flu at day zero, and then we followed their disease state. And you see here we're measuring change in body weight. It's a very good surrogate for their overall health because mice have a very high metabolism. And when they get the flu, they stop eating. And when they stop eating, they rapidly lose weight. When they feel better again around day 8 or 9, they tend to go back to work, which for a mouse means they start eating again. And you see they rapidly gain weight and they go back to normal health. So this sort of looks like what would happen in a human being who gets the flu. It takes a couple of days to really get going. Then they feel really lousy. They stay home from work. They get better. They go back to work, and they're fine again. This is a very mild titer of virus that we gave them here. In the red are animals that were given 100 parts per billion of drinking water arsenic for several weeks before infection with the flu. At 100 parts per billion, which is twice the previous U.S. drinking water standard. And in this case, they get sicker, quicker, and they get very, very sick after a few days of that. And in fact, they die after about 8 days. And they die because they mount virtually no immune response to this flu infection in their lungs. Their lungs fill up with fluid, they hemorrhage, they get extremely sick and morbid, and we have to actually stop the experiment at that point. Very unexpected result, but quite remarkable. We were interested in the idea of an in utero exposure of mice to arsenic, and then later in life exposing them to the flu, similar to the Chilean situation that Dr. Smith described, but we got a little sidetracked on that, and I want to talk about that next. So the other thing that interests us is arsenic and metabolic diseases. Epidemiology has linked arsenic to changes in serum cholesterol and triglycerides, type 2 diabetes, low birth weight, and a number of other metabolically associated illnesses. Next slide. So we set up this mouse experiment here, and again, the original aim was, in fact, to expose them to arsenic in utero and during weaning, stop the arsenic exposure, similar to what happened in Chile, let them grow up to be adults and live their lives for a while, and then, as adults, many weeks later, expose them to the flu and see if they had a different response to that challenge than they would without the in utero exposure. So we see on the left, we took pregnant mice and put them either on control or 10 part per billion arsenic in drinking water. This is the current U.S. drinking water standard. And then at the birth of the pups, we split each group again into either control drinking water or 10 part per billion. And so at the end, we have four groups. A control group, pups that were exposed through the mother postnatally during weaning, exposed through the mother in utero alone, or exposed both in utero and postnatally to arsenic. And the problem that led us to not get to that adult exposure to the flu is that when these pups were born, they were so small and underdeveloped that we were not able to carry out the remainder of that study. And this is most dramatically seen on the right. If you just line up these pups by the nose, you see that the control pup on the left there is pretty big and healthy, but as you go to the right and you see the in utero, the postnatal, and the dual exposure to arsenic, they get smaller and smaller. In fact, these are mice that have been that were born a number of days ago, but if you actually look at them right after birth, the arsenic-exposed pups are extremely retarded in their development. They lack hair, their eyes are closed, they're very small, they're very weak. So there was this very surprising and dramatic effect on growth and development at 10 parts per billion in the drinking water. And this led us to want to follow up on these experiments. So one of the things we found on the next slide there is that if you look at the protein levels in the mother's milk, there's a dose-dependent decrease in both the protein levels and the kinds of proteins in the mother's milk as a function of arsenic exposure. And more dramatically on the right, if you look at triglyceride levels in the mother's milk and also, as it turns out, in her bloodstream, there's a really significant and severe suppression in triglyceride levels in the mother, in her bloodstream, and in her milk, which is affecting the pups. And if you cross-foster the pups, if you take arsenic-exposed pups and put them on a control mom and vice versa, you can actually largely ameliorate this effect in the pups, at least in terms of growth and development, by restoring them to a mother that has normal triglyceride levels. So this is principally a maternal effect in terms of growth and development, but we don't yet know what other effects there are in these pups if they were grown up as adults. And then on the next slide, looking at the moms, you see on the left liver from a control mom and from a mother who was exposed in utero during her pregnancy to arsenic. And you see this very fatty liver. This is something that's very common in humans. Gestational diabetes is common in women, as is fatty liver. A certain subset of women go through what's considered gestational diabetes, where they have a pretty significant shift in their metabolism. This typically resolves after pregnancy, but it's the best risk indicator that those women later in life will develop frank diabetes and other metabolic disorders. And here we're seeing again, at 10 parts per billion in their drinking water, a very dramatic effect on the mother's liver, and we've also looked at her adipose tissue and have seen similar effects. So I'll stop there and take any questions. I just want to acknowledge on this last slide the large number of people over the years who have contributed to the studies I just alluded to, and also, again, thank the NIEHS and their Superfund program for supporting our work. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Hamilton. We'd like to take a few questions over the phone to start with, and if you'd like to ask a question, please unmute your phone by pressing star 7.
This is Pat Cassano from GE again, and this is again based on the article that was sent around with Dr. Henry's note last week. The mouse data seems to show that the female offspring were more susceptible to certain adverse effects as opposed to the male offspring, and that appears to be the opposite of Dr. Smith's study, where the male subjects seem to show higher incidence of effects. Have you given any thought to what might explain the difference between the two studies?
Well, I think that, first of all, the endpoints were different, and secondly, it is mice versus humans. I think that for some effects, we will see modest gender effects, and I do believe that the effects we saw on the females were significant and reproducible compared to the males in that mouse experiment. What she's alluding to, for those who may not have seen this, is that the males who were cross-fostered and then went on chow eventually caught up with their peers in terms of weight gain. The females never caught up, even as adults. They were always small and had other problems. This could be a very specific effect based on the design of this experiment, but it does suggest to us that there may be gender differences, not absolute yes or no of whether a male or female is affected, but more a quantitative kind of effect that might be gender specific depending on the endpoint.
Thank you.
Could we take one more question over the phone for Dr. Hamilton? Okay. I'd like to, just chime in here. These are very striking results that you presented here, Dr. Hamilton. Has there been any epidemiological research that kind of pairs with this or would give some indication, of this, reduced immune response that you're seeing in the animal studies that may be apparent in human populations exposed? Because I'm personally not aware of any, but you may have a better perspective on that.
Well, as I mentioned, the Chile studies do show this effect on bronchiectasis, which I think is certainly consistent with what we saw in the sense that if you suppress the innate immune response in the lung, and we have a number of other kinds of data which show in mice that this is true, then that would certainly be a high risk for diseases like bronchiectasis. There's also studies in Bangladesh and in Taiwan that suggest that there may be immune effects in children who are exposed to arsenic as well. They're not the same endpoints we use, but I think they're, in the few studies that I've seen there is this indication that early childhood exposure may lead to long-term but relatively subtle immune effects based on the epidemiology that I've seen.
And to go to a question from the Internet, we have a question from Yazim from Oregon State University, and the question states, has your group or other groups evaluated multi-generational studies looking at lower levels of arsenic and the health of the F2 pups and disease susceptibility in the F2 and F3 adults?
That's a great question. We have not yet. There are some really interesting studies on alterations in metabolism that suggest to us we should do that, though. There's a really well-known set of studies that came out of the investigation of the Dutch famine, which occurred in World War II, where women who were severely malnourished during that famine and gave birth, their children had lifelong illnesses and either were undersized their whole lives or in some cases the opposite, became obese and had metabolic disorders on the other end of the spectrum. And they now have F2 information from those individuals, and their offspring, even though they went on to lead normal, non-famished lives in the F1s, the F2s also have metabolic disorders that carried over in that generation. So there's this thought that there are epigenetic changes that are occurring in animals when they're exposed in utero and in early childhood, which may not only predispose them to increased health risk, but predispose their offspring as well. It's a very interesting and relatively new field of investigation.
Are there any more questions over the phone? Not hearing any more questions. Before we proceed to have a question and answer for both presenters, one thing that the Superfund research program would like to emphasize is that everybody be aware of the links page and the online feedback form. On the links page, they have assembled resources directly applicable to the presentations that we've heard today, and this will stay up with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We typically place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentations as they were given today. Associated with the links page is an online feedback form, and as we stated previously, you know, please consider filling these out. We continually try to improve the way these presentations are given, as well as, you know, the seminars that are presented here. Links to the additional resource page and the feedback form can be found on the last slide of the presentation. There's one more announcement before we open it up to questions for both presenters. The next webinar in this series will be in January 2013. Registration information will be posted on the Superfund Research Program Risk e-learning webpage as soon as that is available, and it will also be emailed to people that are on the mailing list. At this time, I'd like to open it up to questions for both presenters. Please state your name and your organization and ask your question. Are there any questions on the phone for either presenter?
Mike, this is Brett Moxley with EPA. I'm curious to know if there are any sort of circulating theories as to why arsenic has disruptive properties across all of the studied endocrine systems.
Well, that's under active investigation in our lab, and I think what it comes down to in our minds is this. Unlike the other endocrine disruptors that target individual hormone receptors, arsenic appears to target not the receptors, but the machinery that they share, which allows them to then regulate gene expression. So, and that's a very common machinery that's shared among most hormone receptors. So you could imagine if you target that instead, that you would have these broad spectrum effects on all of the receptors. It's hard to reconcile the data any other way because these receptors structurally don't look like each other. If you line them up either by DNA sequence or protein sequence, they don't show any common epitopes that you might imagine would represent a binding site, for example, for arsenic. So we've turned our attention to this other machinery and trying to understand what that target might be.
Okay. We'll take a couple questions from the Internet. The first question is for Dr. Hamilton. It's from Jimmy Spiro. From DTSC, Sacramento, California. And the question states, the effects that you observed in the C56 black 6J mice were very dramatic. Since Sprague-Dawley rats were reportedly selected for high resistance to arsenic trioxide, your studies on unselected D6 mice are very pertinent. Do you have any comparisons of arsenic susceptibility in other strains or genetic backgrounds?
We do not yet. I'll just make a general comment about mice, though. When we first started our mouse studies, we were told by many reviewers that it was not a good model to study because, in quotes, everybody knew that mice were highly resistant to arsenic. And Dr. Smith presented some of the data from Mike Walkie's group that showed, in fact, you can give them 85,000 parts per billion of arsenic, and they survive that. It's not a dose that you could get away with in a human. And so the thought was, well, they're a very poor model because you can give them these extremely high doses of arsenic and they seem to be, in essence, fine. Then we started doing studies at lower and lower concentrations of arsenic, and we're now publishing studies showing effects at 10 parts per billion, and we're now subject to criticism that, in fact, mice are too sensitive to arsenic and therefore a bad model for humans. You know, which is kind of ironic given what we were talking about 10 years ago. The metabolism of mice is different for arsenic than for humans. They rapidly metabolize, it passes through quickly. So the precise dose that represents to a human is not clear. The C57s we chose are not selected and are kind of the generic mouse. They are the background against which most genetic strains are made for knock-ins and knockouts, and that was why we chose them, so that if we wanted to study the genetics of arsenic effects, that would be our base level, would be a normal C57, and then we could look at, for example, effects of different immune genes or different metabolic genes. We have not yet looked at other strains of mice, but we're planning to do that because there are some natural differences in immune response among different strains of mice that are well known, where either their innate or acquired immunity is fundamentally different depending on the strain. I think this may, I hope, give us some insight into what's going on with this innate immune effect. So I think we can take that kind of a genetic approach in the future.
Are there other questions on the phone for either Dr. Hamilton or Dr. Smith? One question that I would pose, Dr. Hamilton, and, you know, this is one of the few data sets that I've seen where effects have been observed at a very low concentration of arsenic or a dose delivered to an animal, and it's 10 ppb. I mean, are there other data that you're aware of seeing effects at this dose level, you know, in animal models? Because to my knowledge, this is one of the very few.
This is the only report I know of where a physiological effect has been observed at that low a dose. We and others have published a number of different studies at very low doses showing effects on gene or protein expression or particular aspects of the immune system, for example. But none of those studies had some adverse health outcome or some gross physiological endpoint that was associated with them. So I think that. In many cases, because people simply haven't looked that low yet. Dr. Smith was talking about this earlier. One of the reasons we learn more and more when we do epidemiology studies is that the more we dig, the more we find out. And I remember when the Columbia group was proposing to look at cognitive effects in people in Bangladesh. And they were told they didn't think that their funders thought it was not a worthwhile study because people already knew that there were no cognitive effects associated with arsenic. Nobody had ever really done the study before. And Joe Graziano and his colleagues did a very comprehensive study in Bangladesh that showed a dose-dependent decrease in the equivalent of IQ in children exposed to arsenic in the first 10 years of life. That was a surprise, but if they hadn't actually done the experiment, they never would have known that. I think the same is true with low-dose experiments. We're constantly pushing our colleagues to look at the same endpoints they've been looking at previously, but at lower and lower doses to see what will happen there. And I think we'll see more and more studies emerge that show these low-dose effects.
Pat Tassano, again, a follow-up question then. Are there any plans to see if this particular study or these particular studies can be replicated by another lab?
Well, that's not under my control, but I'd be delighted if somebody replicated this. We've done several of these studies ourselves multiple times. We've internally replicated them, but it would be a good idea for others to also look at these kinds of effects and extend what we can do. We're not immunologists, for example, so we don't plan to actively pursue the detailed molecular immunology that would be required to understand some of the effects we've observed. We are focusing on the metabolic effects. We are planning to do a multi-generational study and eventually go back to that study I talked to you about where we expose them in utero and let them grow up to be adults and then see if there are long-term consequences to that. But we may have to lower the dose in order to do that so that we get around the gross developmental effects and so that the pups are at least starting with roughly the same physiology.
Are there any more questions on the phone?
Hi, this is Tamara Sorrell again from GeoSynTech. I'm just wondering whether, you know, either of these gentlemen has a comment on how these studies might relate to exposures in soil, which is the primary exposure mechanism that I deal with, either in ingested dermal contact or inhaled dust.
Well, you know, there were some studies a number of years ago out at one of the big smelters. I think it was Anaconda or one of the big smelter facilities out west, which were looking at urinary arsenic and other biomarkers of arsenic exposure in people upwind and downwind of that large smokestack. And I believe what those studies showed was that very young children who had hand-to-mouth activities did show an increase in internal exposure arsenic downwind of the smelter that related to the dust and dirt levels of arsenic in their environment. Whereas older children who didn't put their hands in their mouths and even gardeners and construction workers who touched and worked in the soil on a regular basis did not as well. Arsenic is very poorly absorbed by the skin, and so it seems to me that that's a much lesser pathway of concern in the abstract. Now, the practical matter is that I think if there's arsenic in the soil at very high levels, it will get into house dust. It is possible through hand-to-mouth activities and other things that one could inhale it in the air or stick it in your mouth or otherwise be exposed to it through inhalation or ingestion. But as a, you know, strictly as a transfer from soil to the skin, I think it's of lesser concern. Is that what you're really getting at?
Well, you know, all of the above, and that's very helpful because, as you probably know, the, you know, risk-based concentrations for inorganic arsenic in soil are, you know, orders of magnitude below what's naturally occurring in background, and something that, you know, we struggle with in exposure assessment all the time. You know, it's hard to tell someone, you know, you need to deal with this situation when, in fact, it's naturally occurring. And, you know, I'm wondering whether these dangers that have been identified associated with drinking water exposure, you know, apply to other media.
Well, I mean, I think it's just a matter of practical exposure. In New Hampshire, we dealt with this question a lot because there are regions of New Hampshire where the soil levels of arsenic are between 20 and 40 parts per million. The average background in the U.S. is something like 5. So you would think, well, these are really high natural levels. But again, I think unless you have a completed exposure pathway, I'm not sure what that means if it's just bound up tightly in the soil, which it is, by the way. Natural arsenic in the soil is bound up by iron and in a precipitate that's pretty immobile. So one would have to eat it, or out west where it's really dry, one would have to inhale it as a dust, I think, to have a completed exposure pathway.
Can I comment? Can you hear me?
Yes, Dr. Smith. Go right ahead. This is open for both presenters.
Right. In the Tacoma area, there was increased uranostic concentrations in all age groups, and we did a study there of with local investigators of lung cancer in women living near the smelter, and felt that there were, although it wasn't clear, that there were some increased risks. And one can relate the soil and dust concentrations and emissions from there, which are very much higher, of course, than in most areas of, or almost any areas of concern in the United States, and extrapolate down to get some estimates of exposure. I also want to comment that the analogy between looking at low-dose mice studies and looking at cognitive function in Bangladesh is not quite what happened. The first studies of cognitive function were in Thailand, and they showed reduced cognitive function in school children. We actually started the second studies in West Bengal, funded by UNICEF, although we actually didn't publish until after the Columbia group had. But the important point is that those three studies involved high concentrations of arsenic. We had arsenic in water, 500, 600, 1,000 micrograms per liter, in urine concentrations, 200, 300, 400 micrograms per liter. And in every study of humans, if we had a group at 10 micrograms per liter, we'd label them non-exposed. That would be our unexposed comparison group. So I have no idea personally how to interpret low-dose mice experiments when much higher doses, such as Wolkes has been giving, do produce effects, but the lung concentrations of arsenic would be at least 1,000 times higher than in these low-dose experiments. So I think the question about replication is very important. I personally don't know how to interpret those studies at all, and know of no reason in the human studies to be concerned about 10 micrograms per liter.
Well, I was just—I think the Columbia study showed that the lowest cohort there was 0 to 50, and then the next cohort was 50, perhaps to 100 or something, that showed a significant decrement in cognitive function. So I think, you know, as you pointed out, Dr. Smith, I think epidemiology studies are—it's going to be harder, unless you have really large numbers, to see effects at low doses. And there's a point where one has to sort of extrapolate. Margaret Karagas's case control studies in New Hampshire suggested that the deflection point where you began to see an increase in skin cancer and bladder cancer was somewhere between 10 and 50 parts per billion in drinking water, and that correlated with their toenail concentrations of arsenic. So I think some of the epidemiology studies are actually starting to approach some of these low doses that we're using in animals.
Right, and I think they need to be assessed very carefully and examined. It's very easy to produce spurious results in low-dose epidemiology studies.
With that, we'd like to take, you know, a couple more questions from the Internet, and this question is probably more directed at Dr. Smith. And the question is from Mary Ellen Starodub of Burlington, Canada, and it states, have you ever looked for or observed an association between arsenic exposure and endometriosis or endometrial cancers?
We have looked at cancer of the cervix in mortality data in Chile and do not find it to be elevated. So at least as far as the human epidemiology studies go, I am not aware of those studies of endometriosis itself. But other, at least the cancer effects are not apparent.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Smith. Are there any more questions on the phones?
Either Hello? Hello?
Can you hear me?
Go ahead. Yes, go ahead.
This is Humphrey Yao from NIEHS. And I have a question for Dr. Hamilton. And this is regarding to the endocrine disrupting property of the arsenic exposure. And I believe those studies were mostly done in the in vitro cell lines. I'm wondering if there's any in vivo evidence to show that arsenic does mimic or interfere with hormones such as sex steroids during development.
I showed you the frog results, which is was an in vivo experiment, and we for development, and then for just other endocrine effects, we published a series of studies in killifish showing a strong endocrine effect. Killifish are fish that live in estuaries, and they go back and forth between fresh and salt water with the tides, and which sounds trivial, but it's actually a remarkable physiological feat to switch their bodies from salt-free to salt water and be able to adapt to that salt change. And the way they do this is principally through upregulation of the glucocorticoid hormone and through the glucocorticoid receptor. And if you have those fish in the presence of arsenic, there's a concentration where in fresh water they're fine, and that same concentration if they're in salt water they're fine. But if they're in that concentration in fresh water and you ask them to transition to salt water, they die, and they die because they cannot make the physiological switch that's required for them to adapt and survive in the salt water. So it's precisely what we would predict that arsenic would do if it's blocking that glucocorticoid pathway. So we've got a series of those kinds of studies we've done in vivo as proof of principle.
And how about the mammalian system then?
We haven't published this yet, but we have a study in liver which shows that arsenic completely flips the gene expression profile of the liver in response to glucocorticoid hormone in the presence of arsenic in drinking water. And we see a similar pattern in the lung. So at the molecular level, we can see that in the whole animal, we're seeing the exact same kinds of gene expression changes that we would have predicted from the cell culture experiments.
Thank you. I have another question regarding to the experiment for the mouse. Did you look at the reproductive system and function for those mice when they get to adulthood?
We have not brought them to adulthood yet. Actually, the pups from those experiments, we terminated the experiment because we needed to look at endpoints within the animals because of their growth deficits. In the mothers, we looked at both the length of gestation, the number of pups, pup resorption, and some other reproductive outcomes for the moms themselves. And we didn't see any effect on gestational length, litter size, or any signs of changes in resorption. What we did see, which we haven't published yet, because we really need to follow it up and repeat it, is that the way the experiment's done is we actually put the mice on the arsenic first and then mated them with males a few days later so that they would have a steady state of arsenic from the moment of conception. And the females on the arsenic had a much lower fertility rate. These were naive virgin females that were about 9 weeks old from the breeder when they were bred. And there was less than a 50% pregnancy success rate in the arsenic females than in the controls, which were between 80 and 90%, which is pretty typical in these experiments. As I said, we haven't followed that up, but it was a rather surprising finding. And that has to do with either fertilization or implantation.
Is there any effect on the male then, if you expose the father arsenic during the breeding period? Do you see a decline in terms of fertility for those males?
I haven't done that yet.
Okay. Thank you.
Is This is a question that we received over the internet from Michael Hutchison from the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, and this is for either presenter. And the question states, in both Chile and Bangladesh, are there possible co-exposures with other neurodevelopmental toxicants that may take place? And following up on that question, can you comment on the possible challenges of data interpretation or confounding roles of perchlorate in Chile or manganese in Bangladesh?
Well, let me comment on Chile. There is perchlorate in some parts of Chile, but it's not concurrent with the arsenic exposure. It's in different towns. So perchlorate is not an issue there, and nor is manganese. In Bangladesh, there's been a lot of discussion and work by the Columbia Group on possible effects of manganese as well as arsenic, although, as I understand it, they're thought to be independent effects.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any studies that link those either. As you probably know, multiple exposures is a very complex problem, both in epidemiology, but even in the lab. It's very difficult to add even just two chemicals together when you think of all the different combinations and the controls and then trying to understand what effects there might be. I would say in general, though, there's very good evidence from epidemiology and some of the studies that we've done as well, that arsenic does tend to work in concert with other risk factors. So in the case of our mice, it was arsenic plus pregnancy. Arsenic plus smoking is a combined risk. Arsenic plus other metabolic or environmental risk factors may be risk. So certainly when you go to the real world, these are things we'll have to consider, is whether they're additive or synergistic or interact in some other complex way.
Okay, are there any more questions over the phone?
Hi, this is Mark Madaloni from EPA Region 2. After Dr. Smith's presentation, there was a question regarding the role of balance state in toxicity, and it was explained that even the pentavalent forms get reduced before they get methylated, so in effect diminishing that impact. My question is, you know, we keep talking about inorganic arsenic, and is the toxicity that tied to whether the arsenic is or is not complex to a carbon moiety, and are all carbon complexes equal? And we know a lot about arsenopatine being relatively low in toxicity, but that's a highly complex arsenic compound. Does any complexation with carbon impart some, mitigation of toxic effect?
No, it's much more complicated than that. The first two steps of methylation are to form monomethyl and then dimethyl arsenic, and the toxicities of those compounds, depending on the valence and the test, can be equal or greater than that of the inorganic arsenic that you started with. Then when you get to the higher methylated forms, the toxicity can drop dramatically, but in mice and humans, it's usually those first two forms you're worried about, is the monomethyl and the dimethyl arsenic. And the degree to which people methylate can complicate the interpretation of their exposures. And certainly there are a number of groups now looking at this and trying to do individual speciation of exposed people to understand how this affects their individual risk in terms of clearance of the arsenic, but the steady state of these intermediate methylated forms. There's been some confusion on this with the recent discussion of arsenic in food. There have been some statements, for example, that I've seen where people have simply divided them in half and said inorganic arsenic's bad, organic arsenic is fine, and it's clearly not that simple, and it really depends on the form you're talking about. There's an organic form of arsenic that's used as a chicken feed additive, for example, and we now know that both in the chicken and in microbes in the soil, the inorganic arsenic can be released from that organic moiety so that it doesn't remain as an organic form. So that's another complication to some of these species in the environment.
Okay, this is Mark Madaloni again. I just, if I may, to follow up, I asked that question because EPA right now is in the process, in this IRIS program, of reassessing, quote, inorganic arsenic, and I'm just wondering if we might be missing something by just making that an effective right line, inorganic versus organic, and should the, should the review be expand it a little to some organic forms?
That's a philosophical question, perhaps, but I think if you're thinking about it in terms of exposure, then inorganic arsenic absolutely dominates human health concerns. We're rarely exposed to organic forms of arsenic compared to the many diverse ways and high levels where we can be exposed to inorganic arsenic. So,
well, we get exposed a lot through fish, right? through organic arsenic. But that seems to be written off.
Well, that is a very good point. Arsenobutane is very rapidly excreted by humans, though. But nevertheless, the idea anything is non-toxic is a dangerous thought. But all the same, it would certainly seem that there's a lot of reason to think that arsenobutane in fish is relatively harmless. I think there's one exception, and that's DMA, dimethylated arsenics, that are present in, for example, seaweed, if you have sushi, they're present in some, are ingested as DMA. And I think I agree with Dr. Hamilton that the main concern by far is in organic forms, but if it were to be expanded at all, I think it's possible that DMA could be added.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Great presentation by both of you.
Are there any other questions on the phone? We'll take one more question from the Internet, and this question states, it's from Yasmin from Oregon State University, and the question states, how do U.S. dietary exposures to arsenic correspond to exposures seen in water ingestion in Chile?
Well, they're dramatically lower. The ingestion in Chile back in time was 850 micrograms per liter, and they had no other water source, so they were probably averaging 2 liters a day, 1.5 to 2 liters a day at 850. So that's more than 1,000 micrograms a day. The areas of concern about food are in the range of 10 to 100 micrograms that might come from food. A typical ingestion might be around about 10 micrograms. But then in certain special settings that I mentioned before, baby rice, for example, some arsenic levels in baby rice are such that the baby would be having the equivalent of drinking 100 micrograms per liter in water. So certainly that is a matter of, I think, concern and needs attention. But all the same, these exposures are very much lower than the exposures in Chile and Argentina, Bangladesh, India, and so on.
That's right. But I think there is this emerging concern about arsenic in food that requires considerable attention. I think it's pretty clear the bioavailability of arsenic in food is roughly comparable to that in water in the inorganic form, and that there are many potential sources of arsenic. So our total arsenic exposure in any day is a combination of all of these sources, and baby food and baby food from rice in particular, but also there's this stuff called brown rice concentrate, which is used as a feedstock, as an alternative to corn syrup, which is used in many food products. And you're taking brown rice, which has high arsenic compared to other foods, and then you're highly concentrating it and adding it to other foods. And for example, some of these energy bars that are made with this product have really heroic levels of arsenic in them that would be several times what you would get from drinking water.
Several times from drinking water at what level?
At, say, the 10 to 100 range that we're worried about in the U.S., not the levels in certainly in Chile or places like that. But
well, then they should have very high concentrations in their urine.
That's right.
So that needs to be checked.
Mm-hmm. So we'll take one more question from the Internet, and this question is from Jimmy Spiro, DTSC from Sacramento, California. And the question states, do you have any thoughts about the suitability of various cancer slope factors for arsenic? The 1999 EPA oral cancer slope factor of 1.5 milligram per kilogram day is based on skin cancers in humans versus the California OHIHA cancer slope factor of 9.5 milligrams per kilogram day. And the proposed IRIS arsenic draft value of 25.7 milligrams per kilogram per day are based upon lung and bladder cancers in humans. Any thoughts on updating the cancer slope factors, and also should we be updating the non-cancer RFD for arsenic? We saved the best for last.
Well, the slope factors have been of considerable interest for many years. In fact, our first reason really for getting into arsenic was being asked by California EPA to assess the risks, and that led us to look at Taiwan studies and then do all our own. So we have been involved with estimating slopes for many years. And I might note, though, that the slope's so high, whatever way you estimate it, that it produces risk estimates that are extraordinarily high. At 10 micrograms per liter, for example, we estimated back in time 1 in 500 deaths. And clearly you don't want to have 1 in 500 deaths from drinking water if that were a real estimate. In fact, there's some reason to think it's an underestimate. But all the same, 1 in 500 is not something we'll ever prove in epidemiology. So my answer is yes, I think it needs to be updated. I do think it's rather astonishing that the slopes are still based on Taiwan data from many, many years ago only, whereas there is a wealth of data in different studies and different populations, which I think should be incorporated. But at the end of the day, these risk estimates come out very high, as long as one doesn't assume a threshold. And I know of no good reason to think there would be a threshold. So that would be my answer. Yes, they need updating, but it's not going to make a big difference. The risks will be very high.
I agree with that. I'm beyond just the calculations of risk factors and slopes. Dr. Smith made the point that, you know, a high fraction of the total people living in that region in Chile will die of an arsenic-related illness. If you add all the risks up of all the different illnesses, it's really quite astounding. And similar calculations have been done in Bangladesh. I think what's remarkable is how close the known risks from arsenic are from epidemiology studies compared to the drinking water standard in relation to any other drinking water contaminant you can think of. So if you take the typical approach that we know those studies will not be able to accurately look at very low doses, and then you have to add certain safety factors for the most vulnerable in the population, it seems clear that these numbers have to be revised in some way. But then you bump up into a technical problem, which is that we can't set a drinking water standard below which we have accurate ways of measuring it or remediating it. So we're kind of stuck with this technical problem on the one hand. On the other hand, these very, very high calculations of risk.
Well, thank you for your responses, Dr. Allen and Dr. Hamilton. With that, we're approaching the end of our time for these presentations. I would like to thank both of the presenters for the presentations that they gave. It's very interesting material, and I think it was a very responsive discussion, question and answer session that we've had following those presentations.
I'd like to encourage everybody, I mean, if you have follow-up questions, to please email the presenters, as well as fill out the questionnaire for the Superfund research program for the seminar series. With that being said, I would like to close this presentation, and until the next one in January of 2013. Thank you all for attending.